Chapter 31. We're spending drinking chocolate, strolling in the gardens and visiting the fish ponds, meanders and other wonders of the villa. Thence the greater number of guests were soon drawn to the card tables, from which they rose only to dine. And after an elaborate dinner prepared by a French cook, the whole company set out to explore the country, or to exchange visits with the hosts of the adjoining villas. Each evening brought some fresh diversion. A comedy or an operetta in the miniature theater, an al-fresco banquet on the terrace, or a ball attended by the principal families of the neighborhood. Odo soon contrived to reassure the Marquess as to his designs upon Miranda, and when Pierre Volant was not at cards the two young men spent much of their time together. The Marquess was never tired of extolling the taste and ingenuity with which the Venetians planned and carried out their recreations. "And nature herself," said he, "seems the accomplice of their merrymaking, and in no other surroundings could man's natural craving for diversion find so graceful and poetic an expression." The scene on which they looked out seemed to confirm his words. It was the last evening of their stay at Bellocchio, and the procuratessa had planned a musical festival on the river. Festoons of colored lanterns wound from the portico to the water, and opposite the landing lay the procurator's Bucentaur, a great barge hung with crimson velvet. In the prow were stationed the comedians, in airy mythological dress, and as the guests stepped on board they were received by Miranda, a rosy Venus who, escorted by Mars and Adonis, recited an ode composed by Cantapresto in the procuratessa's honor. A banquet was spread in the deck house, which was hung with silk arras and Venetian mirrors, and, while the guests feasted, dozens of little boats hung with lights, and filled with musicians flitted about the Bucentaur like a swarm of musical fireflies. The next day Odo accompanied the procuratessa to Venice. Had he been a traveler from beyond the Alps he could hardly have been more unprepared for the spectacle that awaited him. In aspect and customs Venice differed almost as much from other Italian cities as from those of the rest of Europe. From the fanciful stone embroidery of her churches and palaces to a hundred singularities in dress and manners, the full-bottomed wigs and long gowns of the nobles, the black mantles and head draperies of the ladies, the white masks worn abroad by both sexes, the publicity of social life under the arcades of the piazza, the extraordinary freedom of intercourse in the casini, gaming rooms and theaters the city proclaimed, in every detail of life and architecture, her independence of any tradition but her own. This was the more singular as St. Mark's Square had for centuries been the meeting place of East and West, and the goal of artists, scholars and pleasure seekers from all parts of the world. Indeed, as Pierre Volant pointed out, the Venetian customs almost appeared to have been devised for the convenience of strangers. The privilege of going unmasked at almost all seasons, and the enforced uniformity of dress, which in itself provided a kind of incognito, made the place singularly favorable to every kind of intrigue and amusement. While the mild temper of the people, and the watchfulness of the police, prevented the public disorders that such license might have occasioned. These seeming anomalies abounded on every side. From the gaming table, where a tinker might set a ducat against a prince, it was but a few steps to the broglio, or arcade under the ducal palace, into which no plebeian might intrude, while the nobility walked there. The great ladies, who were subject to strict sumptuary laws, and might not display their jewels, or try the new French fashions, but on the sly, were yet privileged at all hours, to go abroad alone in their gondolas. No society was more haughty and exclusive in its traditions, yet the mask leveled all classes and permitted, during the greater part of the year, an equality of intercourse undreamed of in other cities, while the nobles, though more magnificently housed than in any other capital of Europe, generally sought amusement at the public casinier assembly rooms instead of receiving company in their own palaces. Such were but a few of the contradictions, in a city where the theaters were named after the neighboring churches, where there were innumerable religious foundations, but scarce an ecclesiastic to be met in company, and where the ladies of the laity dressed like nuns, while the nuns in the aristocratic convents went in gala habits, and with uncovered heads. No wonder that to the bewildered stranger the Venetian seemed to keep perpetual carnival and Venice herself to be as it were the mere stage of some huge comic interlude. To Odo the setting was even more astonishing than the performance. Never had he seen pleasure and grace so happily allied, all the arts of life, so combined in the single effort after enjoyment. Here was not a mere tendency to linger on the surface, but the essence of superficiality itself, not an ignoring of what lies beneath, but an elimination of it, as though all human experience should be beaten thin, and spread out before the eye like some brilliant tenuous plaque of Etruscan gold. And in this science of pleasure mere jeweler's work, though it were the greatest artists had collaborated, each contributing his page to the philosophy of enjoyment in the form of some radiant allegory flowering from palace wall or ceiling like the enlarged reflection of the life beneath it. Nowhere was the mind arrested by a question or an idea. Thought slunk away like an unmasked guest at the Rodato. Sensation ruled supreme, and each moment was an iridescent bubble fresh blown from the lips of fancy. Odo brought to the spectacle the humor best fitted for its enjoyment. His weariness and discouragement sought refuge in the emotional satisfaction of the hour. Here at least the old problem of living had been solved, and from the patrician taking the air in his gondola to the gondolier himself, gambling and singing on the water steps of his master's palace, all seemed equally satisfied with the solution. Now if ever was the time to cry halt, to the present, to forget the traveled road and take no thought for the morrow. The months passed rapidly and agreeably. The procuratessa was the most amiable of guides, and in her company Odo enjoyed the best that Venice had to offer, from the matchless music of the churches and hospitals to the petted supers in the private casinae of the nobility, while Pier Volant and Castelravinato introduced him to scenes where even a lady of the procuratessa's intrepidity might not venture. Such a life left little time for thoughtful pleasures. Nor did Odo find in the society about him any sympathy with his more personal tastes. At first he yielded willingly enough to the pressure of his surroundings, glad to escape from thoughts of the past and speculations about the future, but it was impossible for him to lose his footing in such an element, and at times he felt the lack of such companionship as the Crucis had given him. There was no society in Venice corresponding with the polished circles of Milan or Naples, or with the academic class in such university towns as Padua and Pavia. The few Venetians destined to be remembered among those who had contributed to the intellectual advancement of Italy vegetated in obscurity, suffering not so much from religious persecution, for the Inquisition had little power in Venice, as from the incorrigible indifference of a society which ignored all who did not contribute to its amusement. Odo indeed might have sought out these unhonored prophets, but that all the influences about him set the other way, and that he was falling more and more into the habit of running with the tide. Now and then, however, a vague ennui drove him to one of the bookshops which, throughout Italy, were the chief meeting places of students and authors. On one of these occasions the dealer invited him into a private room, where he kept some rare volumes, and here Odo was surprised to meet Andreoni, the liberal bookseller of Pianura. Andreoni at first seemed somewhat disconcerted by the meeting, but presently recovering his confidence, he told Odo that he had been recently banished from Pianura, the cause of his banishment being the publication of a book on taxation that was supposed to reflect on the fiscal system of the duchy. Though he did not name the author, Odo at once suspected Gamba. But on his inquiring if the latter had also been banished, Andreoni merely replied that he had been dismissed from his post, and had left Pianura. The bookseller went on to say that he had come to Venice with the idea of setting up his press either there or in Padua, where his wife's family lived. Odo was eager to hear more, but Andrea and I courteously declined to wait on him at his lodgings, on the plea that it might harm them both to be seen together. They agreed, however, to meet in San Zaccaria after low mass the next morning, and here Andrea and I gave Odo a fuller report of recent events in the duchy. It appeared that in the incessant seesaw of party influences the church had once more gained on the liberals. Tresker was out of favor, the Dominican had begun to show his hand more openly, and the Duke, more than ever apprehensive about his health, was seeking to conciliate heaven by his renewed persecution of the reformers. In the general upheaval even Crescent I had nearly lost his place, and it was rumored that he kept it only through the intervention of the Pope, who had represented to the Duke that the persecution of a scholar already famous throughout Europe would reflect little credit on the Church. As for Gamba, Andreoni, though unwilling to admit a knowledge of his exact whereabouts, assured Odo that he was well, and had not lost courage. At court matters remained much as usual. The Duchess, surrounded by her familiars, had entered on a new phase of mad expenditure, draining the exchequer to indulge her private whims, filling her apartments with mountebanks and players, and borrowing from courtiers and servants to keep her creditors from the door. Tresker was no longer able to check her extravagance, and his influence with the Duke being on the wane, the court was once more the scene of unseemly scandals and disorders. The only new figure to appear there since Odo's departure was that of the little prince's governor, who had come from Rome a few months previously to superintend the heir's education, which was found to have been grievously neglected under his former masters. This was an ecclesiastic, an ex-Jesuit as some said, but without doubt a man of parts, and apparently of more tolerant views than the other churchmen about the court. But, Andrea and I added, Your Excellency may chance to recall him, for he is the same Abate de Crucis who was sent to Pianura by the Holy Office to arrest the German astrologer. Odo heard him with surprise. He had had no news of de Crucis since their parting in Rome, where, as he supposed, the latter was to remain for some years in the service of Prince Bracciano. Odo was at a loss to conceive how or why the Jesuit had come to Pianura, but, whatever his reasons for being there, it was certain that his influence must make itself felt far beyond the range of his immediate duties. Whether this influence would be exerted for good or ill it was impossible to forecast, but much as Odo admired de Crucis, he could not forget that the Jesuit, by his own avowal, was still the servant of the greatest organized opposition to moral and intellectual freedom that the world had ever known. That this opposition was not always actively manifested, Odo was well aware. He knew that the Jesuit spirit moved in many directions, and that its action was often more beneficial than that of its opponents. But it remained an incalculable element in the composition of human affairs, and one the more to be feared since, in ceasing to have a material existence, it had acquired the dread pervasiveness of an idea. With the epiphany, the wild carnival season set in. Nothing could surpass the excesses of this mad time. All classes seemed bitten by the tarantula of mirth, every gondola hid an intrigue. The patrician's tobero concealed a noble lady, the feminine hood and cloak a young spark bent on mystification, the friar's habit a man of pleasure, and the nun's veil a lady of the town. The piazza swarmed with merrymakers of all degrees. The square itself was taken up by the booths of hucksters, rope dancers and astrologers, while promenaders in travesty thronged the arcades, and the ladies of the nobility, in their white masks and black zendaletti, surveyed the scene from the windows of the assembly rooms in the procurati, or, threading the crowd on the arms of their gallants, visited the various peep shows and flocked about the rhinoceros exhibited in a great canvas tent in the piazzetta. The characteristic contrasts of Venetian life seem to be emphasized by the vagaries of the carnival, and Odo never ceased to be diverted by the sight of a long line of masqueraders in every kind of comic disguise kneeling devoutly before the brilliantly lit shrine of the Virgin under the arches of the Procurati, while the friar who led their devotions interrupted his litany whenever the quack on an adjoining platform began to bawl through a tin trumpet the praise of his miraculous pills. The mounting madness culminated on Gaia di Grasso, the last Thursday before Lent, when the Piazzetta became the scene of ceremonies in which the Doge himself took part. These opened with the decapitation of three bulls, a rite said to commemorate some long-forgotten dispute between the inveterate enemies, Venice and Aquileia. The bulls, preceded by halberdiers and trumpeters, and surrounded by armed attendants, were led in state before the Ducal Palace, and the executioner, practiced in his bloody work, struck off each head with a single stroke of his huge sword. This slaughter was succeeded by pleasanter sights, such as the famous vola, or flight of a boy from the bell tower of St. Mark's to a window of the palace, where he presented a nosegay to his serenity, and was caught up again to his airy vaulting ground. After this ingenious feat came another called the Horse of Hercules, given by a band of youths who, building themselves into a kind of pyramid, shifted their postures with inexhaustible agility, while bursts of fireworks wove yellow arches through the midday light. Meanwhile the crowds in the streets fled this way, and that as a throng of uproarious young fellows drove before them the bulls, that were to be baited in the open squares. And wherever a recessed doorway or the angle of a building afforded shelter from the rout, some posture maker or ballad singer had gathered a crowd about his carpet. Ash Wednesday brought about a dramatic transformation. Every travesty laid aside, every tent and stall swept away, the people again gathered in the piazza, to receive the ashes of penitence on their heads. The churches now became the chief centers of interest. Venice was noted for her sacred music and for the lavish illumination of her favorite shrines and chapels, and few religious spectacles were more impressive than the 40 hours devotion in the wealthier churches of the city. All the magic of music, painting and sculpture were combined in the service of religion, and Odo's sense of the dramatic quality of the Catholic rites found gratification in the moving scenes where, amid the imperishable splendors of his own creation, man owned himself but dust. Never before had he been so alive to the symbolism of the penitential season, so awed by the beauty and symmetry of that great structure of the liturgical year that leads the soul up, step by step, to the awful heights of Calvary. The very carelessness of those about him seemed to deepen the solemnity of the scenes enacted, as though the church, after all her centuries of dominion, were still, as in those early days, but a voice crying in the wilderness. The Easter bells ushered in the reign of another spirit. If the carnival folly was spent, the joy of returning life replaced it. After the winter diversions of carts, concerts and theaters, came the excursions to the island gardens of the lagoon, and the evening promenade of the fresca on the Grand Canal. Now the palace windows were hung with awnings, the islanders in the balconies grew rosy against the sea-worn marble, and yellow snapdragons blossomed from the crumbling walls. The market boats brought early fruits and vegetables from the Brenta and roses, and gillyflowers from the Paduan gardens, and when the wind set from shore it carried with it the scent of lime blossoms and flowering fields. Now also was the season when the great civic and religious processions took place, dyeing the water with sunset hues as they swept from the steps of the Piazzetta to San Giorgio, the Redentor or the Salute. In the fashionable convents the nuns celebrated the festivals of their patron saints with musical and dramatic entertainments to which secular visitors were invited. These entertainments were a noted feature of Venetian life, and the subject of much scandalous comment among visitors from beyond the Alps. The nuns of the stricter orders were as closely cloistered as elsewhere, But in the convents of Santa Croce, Santa Chiara, and a few others, mostly filled by the daughters of the nobility, an unusual liberty prevailed. It was known that the inmates had taken the veil for family reasons, and to the indulgent Venetian temper it seemed natural that their seclusion should be made as little irksome as possible. As a rule, the privileges accorded to the nuns consisted merely in their being allowed to receive visits in the presence of a lay sister, and to perform in concerts on the feast days of the order. But some few convents had a name for far greater license, and it was a common thing for the noble libertine returned from Italy to boast of his intrigue with a Venetian nun. Odo, in the procuratessa's train, had of course visited many of the principal convents. Whether it were owing to the malicious pleasure of contrasting their own state with that of their cloistered sisters, or to the discreet shelter which the parlor afforded to their private intrigues, the Venetian ladies were exceedingly partial to these visits. The procuratessa was no exception to the rule, and as was natural to one of her complexion, she preferred the convents, where the greatest freedom prevailed. Odo, however, had hitherto found little to tempt him in these glimpses of forbidden fruit. The nuns, though often young and pretty, had the insipidity of women secluded from the passions and sorrows of life without being raised above them, and he preferred the frank coarseness of the procuratessa's circle to the simpering graces of the cloister. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.